Good afternoon. So, as I mentioned last time, we're going to be doing exam review today, so I'll just take questions you have and we'll answer them in some order. I have a list of topics we've talked about this semester. Might not be complete, but I just looked at the schedule and wrote things down. So maybe that will help you think of questions, maybe it won't. So I'll just take questions, write them down, and we'll get to them in some order. Yes.
Are you going to have an explanation key for the quizzes, or
is that? Explanations of the quizzes. Okay. I'll just take other questions. No other review questions that people want me to answer, like exam questions to go over? Okay, I'll give you some time to think. So explanations for the quizzes. This would take more time than I have between now and the exam. I can explain selected questions, but because just going through the quizzes and doing that would, you know, it's probably at least 30 minutes a quiz if you want the explanation to be nice and readable. And that is not an amount of time I have between now and the exam. Yes?
Can you explain the page table space question that we had most recently?
Okay, Q26 on page table space required. Okay. Other questions? Yes? Office hours, okay. Other questions? Just, yes.
Could you talk about overlapping TLB and like cash access?
Okay.
Just like, are you going to talk about the stuff, the covered topics, and the additional questions you're about to ask?
So the question, to be clear, that list of covered topics is so you can think of questions. If you don't ask a question about it, I am not going to talk about it. I just did it because I know that someone would ask, what's on the exam? So there you go. Yes.
Can you just go over general exceptions, like the process of like, what goes down?
Exception and handling process, okay. Yes, so yeah, to be clear, that's a list of topics. I'm not gonna go through that list of topics. I assume if you don't ask about it, you know enough that you don't care for me to explain things, yes. Different kinds of exceptions. Okay. Yes.
Can you go over question 5 on the last exam?
Which last exam?
The second midterm.
Okay. Exam 2. You'll have to specify which variant and what's the question about?
It's about the one with the four answers are like four different caches and.
Okay. So replacement. Caches and messages. Okay. Yes.
Someone behind me.
You? Yeah. Okay. There's probably also someone behind you.
Yeah. Can you go over the one on the exam 2 that counts the number of hits? That I think it was like 2 lines of code within that loop, and you had to count the number of misses.
Okay. Cache misses, miscounting, okay. Yeah. Context switches. Okay. Anything else? Yes. Fall 2016, problem 1, what?
Yeah.
On virtual. Yes. Okay. Q7 through 11, which are about. Virtual memory, okay. Anything else? Yes. Pipeline dependencies. Okay. Yeah.
Relating to that, dependencies versus handlers.
Okay. So let's sort some logistical stuff. So TMB, cache accesses, virtual memory. Okay, so office hours. There are office hours today. I have office hours tomorrow. If there are office hours on the calendar, on Thursday, they are supposed to happen. If not, the TA is not doing their job. Yes?
Don't need to know like specific vector instructions, right?
Okay, vector instructions. I'll add that as a thing to talk about. Okay, so quiz 26. Ask a question on how much page table space is required. I believe you this question. So what is that? How do we answer that question? So we want to know how much page table space is required. So we have a two-level page table is information we are given. And we're gonna need to have four pages of actually valid page table entries. Everything else we can mark as invalid. And in order to have those four pages, we need to have four last level page table entries which are valid. So the worst case is we're gonna have a first level ET. And the worst case would be that we have, and that's gonna point to a second level PT which contains entries. So worst case, each entry in its own second level page table. So that would be the worst case. And that would yield, that would imply one first level plus four PTs. Each one page, so five. So that would be the worst case, but we don't have that. So OX10 and OXFF are close. In fact, let's figure out how that virtual page number gets split up into two pieces. So if you remember, we have our VPN, and our page offset, and our virtual address, and we split up our VPN into two pieces. Part one and part two. And this, the first part, determines which second level table is used. So two things share the first part of the virtual page number. They use the same second level table, so we save some space versus that worst case I showed you. And if we look up here, we find out that our page tables at each level contain 4,096 entries. So that means that VPN part one is 4,096 entries, represents 4,096 entries, so it's log base 2 of 4,096 bits, or 12 bits. So the question is, the first 12 bits of the virtual page number, do they match? And our virtual page numbers are, and in total, is 12 plus 12. 12 equals 24 bits. And if we look at the first, so OX10 and OXFF, VPN part 1 is 0. And for OX, the other two addresses, OX500, one, the VPN part one is 5. So both of them, so both of those pairs share a second level page table. So we have one second level table for the both, and one second level table for both of those. So one, so three total tables. Each one page implies three pages. Yes.
Yes. My question is why isn't it include like the actual data page table itself? That was some previous questions, previous exam quiz questions that didn't include.
Because the question asks how many pages of page tables, and the data pages aren't page tables.
Okay. I thought that was just like a wording mistake.
Well, I mean, you can ask both questions. And both are reasonable things to talk about. Okay. Overlapping TLB and cache indices. So, this is the idea that we can start our cache lookup early, even though conceptually our caches just take physical addresses. And the trick is that, in how we think about splitting up the address. So our physical address looks like this, and it comes from a virtual address that looks like this. And we also split up the physical address to determine how we access the cache. So we split it up into a cache tag, a cache index, and a cache offset. And I'll give our table of what all these abbreviations are. PN is virtual page number, PPN is physical page number, PO is page offset, CT is cache tag, CI is cache set index, CO is cache block offset. And the cache index is needed for first part of cache lookup. And the and we have two cases. So this case, cache index includes part of PPN. Can't do set lookup without. Yeah, so in this case, we can't do the overlapping thing. In order to do our first part of our cache lookup, which is look up the set, we have to get the physical page number. We have some information about what the sets are, because we have some of the index bits, but we don't have all of them. So like we could guess a set, maybe, but we can't actually access the actual set with certainty. So we're not gonna be able to do that. So the case where we can do it is where when our picture looks like this. So here, the CI be computed with just the page offset. So even though it comes from the physical address, it only comes from parts of the physical address, we know immediately when we have the page offset. So, can do set lookup without the physical page number. And since we don't need the physical page number, we don't need to do any of our address translation. We just need to look at the page offset, which is the same in our virtual address, and get the index bits there. We'll eventually need the physical page number because it's part of our cache tag. Yes?
How do we find the number of bits for the cache index and the cache offset again?
Question is, how do you find the number of bits for the cache index and cache offset? So we have a bunch of formulas we can use. So we have, for example, the cache size is the block size times the number of sets times the associativity. I probably should give myself more room. And if we take, it turns out that if we take the cache size divided by the associativity, which is the size of each way, is the is that, okay? And if we take log base 2 of both sides, we get S, which is log base 2 of B plus log base 2 of S. And log base 2 of B is the, since it's the log base 2 of the block size, is the number of block offset bits. And sets, and the log base 2 of the other part is the number of set index bits. That makes sense? And that you most generally. And so it turns out that for this particular thing, you can look at the number, the size of each way, and that's going to be equal to, so C divided by E is CI plus CO. So for example, on our last quiz, we asked whether you could overlap with a 32 kilobyte direct map cache. So one way per set, way, sorry, this is log base 2. Way, and that would give us 15 CI plus CO. And we wanted to find out whether that could overlap. And if you looked up, we had that was 15 was greater than 13 bit page offset, 14 bit page offset. So no overlap. So PPN is part of cache index and or cache offset. That's a way you can figure that out. You can use the formulas in other ways, like you can explicitly compute the size of the block offset and then figure out how many blocks there are and then use the number of blocks per set. But the easiest way for this particular type of problem generally is to compute the size of each way, which is the cache index plus cache offset bits. If you want to think about that more intuitively, you can think each way is like a direct map cache, and if I have a direct map cache of size 4K, I store 4K and then I wrap around. So every 4K maps to the same set, and that means that if I only care about the index, it's the address mod 4K for 4K direct map cache or an associative cache where each way is 4K. And if we apply the same thing to the other options, so if we apply this to our 32 kilobyte two-way cache, we have log base 2 of 32 kilobyte divided by two ways, gives us 14 is the number of cache index plus cache offset bits, which is less than or equal to 14 the page offset size, which means that the cache index and cache offset are entirely contained within the page offset. So we have a version of this situation up here, where we don't have to worry about computing the physical page number to look up the cache index or the cache offset. And okay, so any questions about this? Okay, and let's pull up old exams. Website files. 16 finals. So, fall 2016 final question 1. Okay, so here we're given that we have 8K, 2 to the 13 byte pages, two level page table, and page table entries contain present bit readable exec bit, writable bit, bit 0, 1, 2, and bits 60 through 29 are physical page number. And the question asks size of physical address. So our physical addresses have a physical page number and a page offset. So the physical page number, look at how much space is used in the page table entries for that. And for our page offset, you want to look at the page size. So our physical page numbers are 29 minus 6 plus 1 bits. Assuming that's inclusive. Which should give us 23, 24 bit PPN. And our page offsets are 13 bits. So 24 plus 13 bit page offset should give us, yes, 37 bits. Then we have spring 2017. So questions on what I did there? Well, I pull up the spring 2017 final. So we have here, we have 8K pages, same size pages. And PT page table, 1 kilobyte, first level tables, KB second level tables, 4 byte page table entries, and a 16 entry, 8-way set associative TLB. And the first question asks which virtual addresses use the same TLB set as something. As one address. So we want to figure out the organization of the TLB. So we have 16 entries divided by 8 entries per way implies we have 2 sets. Which implies we have 1 set index bit, 1 TLB index set index bit. And the question what? Question 7 is same TLB set as 0x12345678. So there's 1 TLB set index bit, and anything which has that same bit in its virtual address is going to be the same. And the way our TLB sets work is that we have our virtual address, which we split up this, and the TLB only looks up the virtual page number. So we split the virtual page number into a TLB tag and a TLB index. In this case, our index is 1 bit, so we're just looking for what that 1 bit is, which is the lowest bit of the virtual page number. So the question is does bit 13, bit 0 is least significant, the same in each address? And that's what you have to check. Should be a fairly straightforward exercise, given some. If you have, we'll just do the first one. X99345678. So in this case, our 12th bit is at the end of bit 11 is the last bit of 6. So if we split 5, which is 0, 1, 0, 1, then here is bit 12 and here is bit 13. So that's 0, we see if it matches the bit here, and it will because they're part of the same hexadecimal digit in the same place, so better match. We do the same procedure for each address. So then Q8 is how many bits in a virtual page number? And important for this, the question tells us that we have 32-bit virtual addresses. You could maybe guess that that's probably the size from this, but maybe we omitted some leading zeros. So 32 bits is the VPN size plus the page offset size, and we know the page offset size is 13 because we have 2 to the 13 byte pages. 13, so this is 32 minus 13, which is number 19, yeah. Make sure to, it's 19. So Q9, it was how many bits of the page table entry are used? And relevant to this, we are told that PTEs contain physical page number, valid bit, readable bit, executable bit, and kernel only bit. So our physical page numbers are going to be 28 minus 13 equals 17 bits. Yes?
For number 8, do we need to know the whole VPN or separate that into parts?
So it asks how many bits are in a virtual page number. That's the whole thing.
Okay.
Doesn't ask anymore, so you don't need to split it.
Okay.
You could. You won't get the wrong answer if you compute the size of each part and add them together, but you don't need to do that. Yes?
So for number 7,
I'm assuming bit 0 is the least significant one.
Okay.
If you count bit 1 as the least significant, you get different numbers, yes. 15 bits. So, and we add 1, 1, and 1. And 1, and we get 20. 1. Did I miss? Oh, right, I can't subtract 28 and 13. Okay. Yeah. So when we do subtraction properly, bit physical address, valid, readable, writable, and if you actually read the question, you'll find out there's also a writable bit, so this had a separate permission bit for readable, and that gives us 20, which is the answer. And we had also 10. Question 10 was about overlap. And overlap TLB access with 32 kilobyte X-way associative cache. What does X need to be? basically what it's asking. And so the way to think, so you can use what I showed you before, that log base 2 of the cache size divided by associativity equals the cache index plus cache offset, which, and this must be less than or equal to page offset bits to do start cache access early. It has to be just containing the cache offset, the cache index. So we know that if we have log base 2 of 32k divided by 1, that gives us 15, which is not less than or equal to 13. If we have divided by 2, that gives us 14, which is still not. And we have divided by 4, that gives us 13, which is. So 4 is our minimum associativity. And if we increase the associativity, we have our, we move our set, or we have less cache index bits, we have more opportunity to not have to worry about how big the page size is. Okay, and Q11, which addresses share second level page table. So when we do a multi-level page table lookup, we take our VPN and our page offset, and we divide our VPN into parts for each level of the page table. And if we share the first shared, then we use the same second level table, just because that's how we determine where the second level table is, using those bits of the address. So this question is just asking, do these addresses share the first part of the virtual page number? So we need to figure out how big each of those parts are. And if we go up here, we have two level page tables with 1 kilobyte first level tables and 4 byte page table entries. So if our first level table is 1 kilobyte, and we have 4 bytes per entry, that means we have 256 entries in first level tables, which means we need log 2 of 256 is 8 bits to say which entry in the first level. So that means that VPN part 1 is the first 8 bits of the address. So you're just going to look at the first 8 bits. If they're the same, they use the same second level table. If not, they probably don't. So questions on any of that before I talk about exceptions? Okay, so exceptions. So exceptions are cases where the processor decides, I'm going to start running the OS right now. I don't care what's running. I'm going to start running the OS. So we first have to detect, we need to run, we have an exception. Have an exception. And varies on kind, e.g. explicit instruction, invalid memory access, external event, etc. Then we need to save the program counter and maybe more. So the processor is going to overwrite at least the program counter, maybe some other stuff, when it starts running the OS. And we want to be able to get back to where we were so the OS can return from a system call or re-execute a move that accessed invalid memory after it fixes the page table. or tell you where your divide by zero happened. So we're going to need to save the program counter so the OS can do that, and the processor needs to do it because it's about to overwrite it to start running the OS. So then we need to look up the location of the exception handler. Exception handler. And this is using the exception table, which is an array of function pointers. Set by OS, referenced by a special register. So there's some special register that points to the exception table, which is this array of function pointers, one for each kind of exception that the OS sets up. And it's how it tells the processor, here's where I want you to go when you have a page fault, here's where I want you to go when you have a divide by zero, so the OS can do what it wants to do. So then the exception handler runs. And which is part of the OS, I guess, so I missed a step here, which is switch to kernel mode. Then the exception handler runs, which is part of the OS. It's generally, usually, save the context of the program. So all registers, page table, base pointer, etc. In case it wants to switch away. Right. So generally, usually when we have an exception, we might want to switch back to the program or switch to another program. So probably this is the point where we'd save all the state. We definitely at least need to save any registers we're using. We can't rely on there being callee safe registers because an exception could have interrupted any part of the code using any register. And then exception handler does whatever OS decided is a good idea. So the OS gets to make whatever decision it likes. We have some conventional decisions we talked about, e.g. swap in a page, on a page fault, e.g. crash a program, on a divide by zero, e.g. read from a file on a system call. There's lots of options for what the OS does. Okay. So any parts of the exception handling process you want more detail on? Okay. So different kinds of exceptions. So textbook terms, we have in no particular, traps, interrupts, faults, and aborts. So traps are triggered explicitly using an instruction designed to do so. An instruction whose only purpose is doing so. Most notably, system calls. Interrupts triggered externally. E.g. timer, key press, network activity, etc. Faults triggered by per instruction that was supposed to do something else. So e.g. divide by zero, page fault, protection fault. Page or accessing kernel-only instruction, etc. So anything where instruction has a different primary purpose but ends up triggering a fault, triggering an exception, that's a fault. Aborts are triggered by, kind of vague term. Usually serious hardware error signal to the CPU, e.g. your RAM is broken. you know, maybe related to we generally, I will avoid talking about aborts just because I think the distinction between aborts and interrupts and faults is not clean enough that I really want to talk about it that way. And as I mentioned, the terminology for all these differs between every single processor uses different terminology. And I don't think it's actually that useful to test you on lots of terminology besides the basic stuff. Yes?
How is the signal different?
Okay, so signals versus exceptions. Signals versus exceptions. So signals are an operating system feature versus exceptions are a hardware feature. Signals are for user programs. Exceptions are for operating systems. They're to let operating systems do what they want to do. That's the biggest distinction, is that you can think of the difference between signals and exceptions as being similar to the difference between raw I/O devices and flats. That signals are this clean thing that provides many of the same sort of functionality as exceptions do, but are for user programs, not for operating systems. So signal handlers. So handlers run in user mode. Because part of the user program. In exceptions, handlers run in kernel mode because part of the OS. They can be triggered by similar sorts of events, but when OS decides to run it. And this runs when hardware decides to. So whenever a signal handler runs, yes, that may be some hardware event which caused it. Like, it may be I pressed Control C and that made my signal handler run. But it was because the OS decided that should happen, not the hardware. And the OS could change that decision. I could ask the OS to do something else. And other distinction is have different calling convention than normal functions usually. So the hardware maybe could like save the registers itself, but usually, simple. Usually to keep it simple, they won't save everything somewhere and the OS is gonna have to do extra work. Also handle kernel mode. Also, because we need to shift between kernel and user mode, there's some extra stuff the OS might need to worry about, which means you can't do what you normally would do in a function. It's like when you return, you want to return to user mode, or something like that. And you want to worry about multiple processes. Signals generally have same calling convention then because OS libraries do extra work before calling you, before calling the signal. So generally with a signal handler, the OS and its libraries do something before calling the signal handler so you can use the same calling convention because it's meant to be used from C. Because these are meant for user programs, these are meant for you to write in not assembly. So the OS does extra work, which is easy to do in software. The hardware, we want to keep the hardware simple to implement, and we don't care about making the OS do things that are peculiar to our hardware. Okay, so those are the differences. The most important ones are these. And the most important one is, in fact, that first one. If you don't remember any others, remember that one. And you can figure the rest, you can figure the justification for the rest out from there. Okay, context switches. So context is information we need to information the CPU uses when running a process program that we need to save elsewhere when we switch away from it. Right. The context is exactly the information that we need to move off the processor. So that includes all program registers, RAX, RSP, etc. The program counter, we need to know where it is when we come back. And when something else is running, it's going to change that program counter. The page table base register. We need to restore that to its old value. When we do that, we'll have the same address space. So we don't need to copy anything else in memory, because setting the page table base register, assuming we just start another program the usual way, will restore the entire address space the way it was before. And that's why we don't need to like make a copy of the stack somewhere and then copy it back, because changing the page table base register changes what the stack is, and that's all the processor is actually manipulating when we switch programs in the OS. Things like condition codes, because if we have a timer interrupt happen just before you run a conditional jump, you want the condition codes to be the same when we restart at that conditional jump. You know, else you'd be very disappointed. So the context switch is OS copies information in the context to its memory. Information from CPU, and OS copies information from memory in the context to CPU. And this is, first is for program A, program B. And this is switch running program A to running program B. So by copying this information from the CPU to memory and from memory to the CPU, this is how we switch between two programs. And this is typically done as part of many exception handlers. So exception handlers are how the OS gets to run, and many of them are going to do one of these context switches. Any questions on context switches, things I'm omitting that seem important? Okay, so vector instructions. What do you need to know? I'm not going to ask about specific vector instructions intrinsics, unless I tell you about them. Like, if I'm going to ask you about add EPI 16, I will write a sentence like, add EPI 16 is an intrinsic function which takes two values, and which represent vectors of 8 16-bit values, and adds each pair of them together. I will give you that level of detail if you need to know it. I probably prefer not to do that, so you can guess on what type of questions I might ask about vector instructions. The most important things to know that vector instructions have you specify what to do in parallel. You or compiler, I should say. Versus reassociation, multiple accumulator, out of order, where CPU figures out what to do in parallel. That what computations to do in parallel. That's the biggest distinction. So, and so there's certain kinds of things which are easier to do in vector instructions, and there's certain advantages as far as the hardware complexity, right? It's harder to make hardware that looks at all those dependencies, but it also means that when you're writing vector instructions, there's some things which are hard to write using vector instructions because you have to specify that parallelism. And the general concept of, fixed-sized arrays, pairwise operations. Like that we have operate on these fixed-sized arrays we call vectors, and most of the operations take each pair of values from two of them and do something. And that's the sort of, and like if you can express your computation that way, you can use vector instructions well. If you can't, you're not gonna get a benefit from vector instructions. Other questions on vector instructions? Okay, so Cashmis, counting, and such. So let's pull up the exam, the famous exam 2 question. Exams, key to CI. So on here, okay, so we have different, I'll go with the hard one, which was presumably this one. So this question, I'll start with the easy part. So we have this loop here, and the first thing asks about the second question, which is the easier one in this exam, asks about a 4 kilobyte, 16-way set associative cache. So our concern here, the reason we might have cache misses, is going to be conflicts. We're accessing way, way less than the size of either of these caches, so we're not going to have capacity misses. We are going to have compulsory misses. You aren't going to have capacity misses. So first, let's count the compulsory misses. So in this code here, we have, what can I do? Well, that is ugly. So we have compulsory misses. So for array I times 128, there are 16 of these that are going to be misses. On 16 misses in iteration j equals 0. For array I times 128 plus I, one of these, so array 0 times 128 is the same array 0 times 128 plus 0. So that's not a miss. Others, 15 misses in iteration j equals 0. So those are our compulsory misses. So in every case, we're going to have those misses no matter what. Yes?
J equals 0, you mean x equals 0?
Sorry, I mean x equals 0. I don't actually have the exam on my screen. So I mean x equals 0. So those are compulsory misses. So we're going to have those 16 plus 15 misses for every case. And an observation we can make, and that's useful for the next question, is conflict misses. So array I times 128 plus I never conflicts with other values. Other i's, for any I. So we know that because when we look at the size of these caches, we have, so kilobyte or half kilo, we have kilobyte or half kilobyte set ways, and that means that addresses 1 kilobyte apart, so to have conflict, 1 kilobyte apart addresses. So we need addresses which are 1 kilobyte apart. We don't have those with this because they can't have thing blocks which are exactly 1 kilobyte apart. Wait, okay. I did this wrong. That's for the later. We'll get to that later. So with the 16-way cache, it's the big. The 16-way cache, I forgot, has 64 byte cache blocks. So with the 16-way, conflict misses array I times 128 plus I is same block as array I times 128. So with the 16-way, they're the same block, which is relevant here. Yes, they're the same block. So in fact, these are zero misses for the 16-way. 16-way. So I'll do the 16-way first. Okay, because they're the same block. So those are 16 compulsory misses. Since we have 16-way cache, we have 16 blocks, 16 ways, so we have 16 blocks and 16 ways, so there's no possible way to evict anything. Yeah, sorry for forgetting the block size there. So because we have exactly 16 blocks, it doesn't even matter how it maps to sets. You know, even if they're all in the same set, we can store 16 blocks in a set. We aren't going to evict any of them. So we're going to read them once, 16 blocks, and then we're done. And so we have 16 misses for question 10 here with the 16-way cache. So the hard one is the direct map cache, which is what I was getting ahead of myself in explaining. So with the direct map cache, well, 16 ways, no misses. So we'll do the 16-way. So the 1KB direct mapped. So the compulsory misses, we again have this. Well, zero is same as array I times 128. So in the direct map case, we have one case with direct mapped with one byte block. Since it's one byte blocks, for zero, that's the same thing. But the other things are the different blocks, so they're going to be separate compulsory misses. So for array one times 128 plus one is different block than array one times 128 and so on. For zero, they happen to match up. So that's 15 misses in iteration x equals zero. So for conflict misses, we have to have a conflict, we need to have them be 1 kilobyte apart exactly, the blocks. And it turns out that eight times 128 array elements is 1 kilobyte. So array I times 128, so array 0 times 128 and array 8 times 128 are the same set, and the same for 1 and 9 and so on. And that means that it misses every time. Now, array I times 128 plus I, when I equals zero, it's a hit because we just accessed array zero times 128, which is the exact same byte. So it better be a hit since we just accessed it, there's nothing to interfere. Otherwise, nothing else maps to the same set, no other accesses exactly 1 kb apart. Another way of looking at this is you can say that same set, this is set 0, set 128, since the sets are, there's one byte per each set as we keep going, and so on, whereas here we have array 0 times 8 plus 0 is set 0, then 1 is set 129, 2 times 2 is set 258, and each time we add 129 because that's how much we're going forward in an address until we need 129 mod 1024, the number of sets. So we wrap around, but we don't wrap around to ever to the same place. We're off by a little bit because 129 is almost probably relatively prime with 1024, or close to it. And so this means we have our 31 compulsory misses, and we have 16 conflict misses per iteration. And we have per iteration after first. So we have 16 times 9. Which hopefully, 44. And if we add up those two numbers, we have 144 plus 31 equals, hopefully, 175. Okay. So, questions about that? I think that was the hardest question in exam 2 by pretty much any metric. I think it was, So the basic thing to look for is first figure out the compulsory misses. Those are usually easy. And the question for the compulsory misses is you need to look at the block size and not forget there's different block sizes and say when are things in the same block and figure out the first time we access each cache block. And count the number of those. Then look for conflict misses. When do things map to the same set? And you need to look at the associativity and see, do we have too many things mapping to the same set or not? If you don't, it's easy. Then there's no conflict misses. If you do, then you may have a miss. So the question is, do we access something a second time? Are there enough intervening accesses? With a direct map cache, if we ever access the same set or something else before, in between, we're in trouble. With an associative cache, you need to make sure, you need to look at the replacement policy, and then look at how many intervening accesses. Do we run out of blocks in the set or not? Yes.
In general, how do you know if two things map to the same set?
So how do you know if two things map to the same set? So the rule we had here was that they're 1 kilobyte apart exactly. And this corresponds to have the same, Oh, whoa, okay. That is... Was that true for the past 5 minutes? Okay, great. I'm pleased I'm posting these notes. Okay, so the rule is that the blocks are 1 kilobyte apart exactly. And this is the same as the set index bits are the same. So in this case, our set index bits go up to bit 10. Our bits, 0 through 9. So changing bit 10 plus doesn't change the set. So generally, you want to see how can I change values? What's the number I have to increment by to not change the set index bits? So you just look where the set index bits are, and one bigger than that, changing the bits higher than that, which you can do by shifting one over that many bits and adding that value, is not going to change the set you're in, and those two things are going to conflict. So you look at that and say, are the blocks that far apart? They are, and the index bits are the same, they conflict. And sort of the another way of thinking about it is if the two blocks, which are number of bytes in a way apart, conflict. Because when we go through a way, when we take the number of bytes in a way, you think each time you advance by a block, you go down like a row in the cache, and then you wrap around. The number of bytes you have to advance to wrap all the way around and back to the start is the number of bytes you store in each column. So that's another way of thinking about it. Other questions about this? Okay, pipeline dependencies and dependencies versus hazards. So pipeline dependencies, we had data dependencies and hazards, which are, so data dependencies are need a value from a previous instruction, usually a generally register value, possibly like a condition code value. Control dependencies are need PC computed by previous instruction. That we need some instruction to actually know what the program, what instruction we're actually executing, we don't know without the previous instruction. Without the dependencies, we just don't know some value we're computing on. So hazards versus dependencies. All hazards are dependencies, are dependencies. Hazard means with a particular pipeline, instruction would not execute because of this dependency. So a dependency is a hazard if we look at our pipeline, we say, oh, if I don't do anything, the instruction would not execute correctly. So, example, data hazard would need to forward or stall. Control hazard need to stall, predict, or run wrong instruction. Yeah. So where if we don't do something, you know, so like stalling, forwarding, branch prediction. That if we don't do one of those techniques, we're in trouble, then it's a hazard. There are cases where we don't have to do that. So most notably, if you write a register and like 50 instructions later read it, that's not a data hazard. It might be a dependency, probably is a dependency if you don't write the register in the meanwhile, but it's not a data hazard because we don't need to do anything in our 5-stage pipeline to deal with it. And with it, as long as your pipeline doesn't have like 50 stages, you won't need to do anything in the pipeline to deal with it. So any questions about hazards or other topics I should talk about in our remaining 5 minutes? Yes. Spring 2017 question four. Okay, so four, which is on, so we have a CPU with where with various stage times, where fetch is 1 nanosecond, decode is 0.8 nanoseconds, execute is 0.5 nanoseconds, memory is 1.2 nanoseconds, and write back is 0.8 nanoseconds. And the question, Q4, is split the memory stage. Each half takes 0.6 nanoseconds. Now, previously we got 2 cycles per instruction. Now 10% instruction stall 1 more cycle than before. Yeah. What? Okay. Question 12. Oh, okay. That's an easier one. Okay, so covered topics, not fork. I can gladly talk to you about fork, but we're going to cover that this semester beyond mentioning that it's how Unix creates processes and it does this weird copy and write thing, but we didn't cover it, so we won't ask that. That question really is about fork, not more than signals. We won't cover that. Yeah, if fork appears in the code for the question, it won't be on it. We won't talk about it. Yes? Well, the questions may be very similar to midterm questions, but I will at least change something. Okay, other questions? Before I finish up, so good luck on the exam. Thank you for a good semester.